So, the big book says this. It says, how shall we present that which has been so... I'm Blind Dave. I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety date is July of 98, so it's coming up here in about a month. Very good. Hope y'all don't mind that I'm not wearing a suit and tie. I don't know if y'all expected that or not. Hope I didn't shock you. I try to wear them if I'm speaking, you know, at a conference or something, but I'm just not into doing that when I'm at the home group, you know, down here. So I hope y'all don't mind. But anyway, it says, how shall we present that which has been so freely given to us? We have concluded to publish an anonymous volume. You know, in the early days of AA, they really struggled over how they were going to spread this wonderful message all over the country. And they debated about it. They had meetings about it. And they thought maybe we'll start some AA hospitals or something. They went through all kind of stuff. And finally, when the dust settled, they concluded to write a book. It says, setting forth the problem as we see it, we shall bring to the task our combined experience and knowledge. So my job is to try to take my experience and somehow weave it in and out of this book to see if I can't help maybe somebody, particularly the new people, get a better grasp on the book. So that's what I'm going to try to do tonight. It says in the chapter, Working with Others, to be careful not to brand him as an alcoholic. Speak of alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady. Talk about the conditions of body and mind which accompany it. So I do that a lot. You know, this is an illness that that if you want to get treated for it, that treatment will not be successful until you diagnose yourself as in need of this program and that you want it and are willing to do it. So I'm just going to set forth a little bit of a description of alcoholism and let you decide if you're one. That I'm talking to the new people. So, in describing the conditions of body and mind that accompany alcoholism, I found four common conditions. I'm going to discuss each one briefly. And so I'm going to list them as A, B, C, and D. A, we're going to talk about the physical addiction. There is a physical aspect to alcohol and drug addiction. And so the big book says this in the doctor's opinion. The action of alcohol upon these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. Whoa. That was a foreign concept to me, allergy. You know, I grew up, my folks lived right next to the woods, and I played in the woods all the time. I had a childhood friend who was always getting poison ivy. I was running right along behind him through the same brush and stuff he was, and I never got poison ivy. My mother said it's because I was hypoallergenic. And so I've never had an allergic reaction to soap or colognes or any of that kind of stuff. Every time I've ever gone to the doctor and they hand me the papers that you fill out and says, do you have high blood pressure? Do you have diabetes? Have you had all your childhood diseases? And then it says, are you allergic to any medications? I've always said, no, I'm hypoallergenic. Then I landed in AA and they said, well, Dave, you have an allergy. I said, no, I don't. I'm hypoallergenic. That's what my mother told me. No, we're talking about the phenomenon. It says the action of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. The phenomenon of craving is limited to this class, never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. All the, you know, Dr. Silkworth said he didn't really know what to call it. He knew it was a physical phenomenon that was triggered when I put it in my body. He didn't know what else to call it. It didn't actually fit the description of allergy, but he didn't know where else to put it, so he put it in the category of an allergy. But all he meant by that was the phenomenon of craving. Oh, yeah, okay. I know what you mean. Because when I take a drink, I get kind of an unusual itch for another one. So I related to that, and it goes on to say, we know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. We don't mean stop for a day or a week. We're talking about stop as a way of life. It becomes virtually impossible for him to stop. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took that first drink, which sets the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind, not in his body. So, you know, the allergy really isn't the big problem of alcoholism. If the allergy was all there was to alcoholism, there's a simple solution. Don't take a drink. And if you've had your butt kicked enough by alcoholism, you would say, don't worry, I won't. And that's what they say. We get them in the treatment center. They're pretty beat up and bloody. You know, people say, when I came into recovery, man, my ass was on fire. Well, yeah, probably your whole life was on fire. You may need some help with detox. That's what treatment centers are for, to get some medical assistance with that detox so you don't have a seizure or something. So we get them in there. We give them that medical assistance. We get them detoxed. We get it out of their system. The allergy has stopped. And we say, now don't do that again. And that's what they say. Don't worry, I won't. You open the door and let them out, and they go jump back in the fire. We do that over and over and over, and we've done it for centuries, and we've baffled society. Why do we do that? Obviously, the main problem of the alcoholic isn't this allergy. We've stopped that. We've arrested that. Why did he go back out and jump back in the fire again and again and again? Something wrong with his head. So we're going to look at B, the mental obsession. It says, you know, what happens is this allergy has caused me to keep reaching for a drink until it has become an obsession over a period of time. It has become an obsession. And, you know, you can relieve me of that physical itch for another drink, but once it has gotten deep into the core of my mind, you can't ever stop the mental itch for a drink. The big book says most of us have been unwilling to admit that we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other men. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it to the gates of insanity or death. And that means I go back out and jump back in the fire over and over and over, thinking I can do it different this time. But you know, once you get me detoxed and get the physical allergy to subside, I'm left with this mental itch that I can't get rid of. But it's not that overpowering in itself. It's just a little thing that keeps tapping me on the shoulder from time to time saying, did you say your wife's going to be gone all weekend? You know, that kind of, did you say you got $1,000 bonus for Christmas? What I could do with that? Particularly if the old lady didn't know I got it. You know, so it's always tapping me on the shoulder and making little suggestions about a plan to get a drink. And that is always with me. It's going to be with me forever, that it will tap me on the shoulder from time to time if it thinks it can catch me not looking and slip a drink under my nose. But it's not that overpowering of a voice in my head once the allergy has subsided and I've put a little distance between me and the little glass drink. But it is persistent. Once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, which I'll probably eventually it will happen if it just keeps tapping me on the shoulder. Once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens. Oh, God, now I've lit up the allergy again, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. You know, I get them both going, the allergy and the obsession, and it becomes a loop, a self-sustaining loop. It's just like if I've got a microphone in my hand talking through a PA and I get a little bit too close over here to that speaker, what happens? Yeah, that's right. I get a feedback loop going. The sound goes in the mic, out the speaker, and back in the mic. And now I've got this squeal happening, and it's a self-sustaining loop. It won't stop. You'll have to either move me away from the speaker, or someone will have to run over there and turn it off. We got to break the loop somehow, because it won't stop on its own. So that's what I've got going here, is I've got a self-sustaining loop that it takes bigger and bigger consequences to break me out of. So both of these conditions are progressive. You know, in my when I was young, I'd pull a good drunk for a weekend, and by Sunday morning, maybe I felt a little rough, and I didn't want no more. And that would keep me sober until about next Thursday, and I'm thinking of Friday, looking forward to it. But on Monday, you couldn't interest me in another drink. But by Thursday, I'm thinking about Friday. And you know, as time progressed, my weekends began to spill over into the weeks. And then it took a little bit bigger things to break me out of the loop. I had to run out of money or spend the rent and get the old lady pissed off or something. And you know, so the problem started piling up and the consequences started getting bigger, and it took bigger consequences to break me out of the loop. So what we mean by being progressive, it gets harder and harder for me to break out of the loop as time passes, and it gets easier and easier for me to fall back into it. That's what we mean by its progression. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently may be has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. That means I can't hardly get myself out, and I can't hardly keep myself from falling back in to the loop. It led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness over any considerable period. It gets worse, never better. All of us, when I was a kid, I started drinking probably in high school and experimenting with a few drugs. And hey, I was drinking right along with the normal drinker then. You couldn't tell me apart from him. It was just sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and we were having a good time. And, you know, then we graduated from high school, and some of us went and got a job, and some of us went off to college, and the parties got bigger and better. And he started drinking more, and I started drinking more. But it wasn't, for him, it wasn't the progressiveness of the illness. It was freedom from mom and dad. It was a circumstantial situation that allowed him to drink more. And I was drinking right along beside him and thought I was drinking more for the same reason he was. But here's what happens. See, somewhere about his mid-20s, usually it's around our mid or late 20s when we all of us kind of reach a place in our life, the normal drinker too. He wakes up one morning, his old lady's pissed off, his boss is pissed off, and he says, you know, this foolishness is going to cost me my marriage, my wife. I'm going to lose my wife. I'm going to lose my job. I better cut back. And he thinks about it, and he decides, you know, I can probably drink responsibly about up to this much without pissing people off. And he promises his wife, and he promises his boss that he won't do it anymore, to excess. And he does. He drinks up to that line. He draws a line in the sand. He drinks up to that line, and he stops. Now, I'm just like him. I woke up about 24 years old and decided, oh, man, you know, I'm fixing to trash my life. I'm going to have to cut back on this foolishness. And I did the same thing. I thought about it. I decided I could responsibly drink up to about this much. And I promised my wife and I promised certain folks, and I drew a line in the sand and told them I'll drink up to this line, and that's it. And this is where the difference between me and him began. Because, you see, for him, when he drew a line in the sand, that was the end of the matter. When I drew a line in the sand, that was the beginning of the matter. I didn't know I had a problem till then. Not really. And from that day on, my life became characterized by countless vain attempts to try to prove I could be like him. And sometimes I thought I was succeeding. It says all of us felt at times that we were regaining control. But these intervals were usually brief, and then inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. And becoming convinced is when I hit bottom. When I become convinced that I'm not going to be able to pull this thing out before it hits the ground. You know, I mean, you're falling from the sky, and you're trying to pull out, and you finally become convinced. Prepare for impact, you know. But this is a progressive illness. And we've had some hard experiences in learning the nature of the progression of alcoholism. You know, back in the old days when there was no solution to this program, people knew what it meant to be low-bottom drunks. When AA first got started, they were coming from all over the country, and they were near dead, and they were desperate. The big book says they had the desperation of a drowning man. That's a lot of desperation. But we've kind of lost that today because we've got recovery on every corner in the city, and you know, not many of us have ridden it all the way to the end like that. So we have to try to help people see the early stages of alcoholism and make them connect with that and see the bottom coming, maybe. You know, cancer is a progressive, uncurable disease. Alcoholism used to be a progressive, uncurable disease. And it was not a pretty end. It struck terror in the hearts of society if you were pronounced as one. And about the only thing in our society today that has been close to that would be cancer. Although we've made a lot of progress with cancer, I know just not too many years back, if someone got that diagnosis, it struck terror into the hearts of the whole family. Mom has cancer. Because we know that we're just going to fight with it as long as we can, but it's going to win in the end. And it's not going to be pretty. You know, suppose way back in primitive society, some, you know, tribal chief or witch doctor, and somebody came and said, Doc, I've got this little sore bump right here. And the witch doctor says, oh, me got fix, you know, and he's got some little snake oil. He says, rub this on there, and it'll fix anything. So you rub that, and you rub that, and you come back in a few weeks, and he say, all well? He say, no, Doc, I've used up the whole bottle, and in fact, it's got a little bigger, and it's hurting a little more. And he said, oh, here's my best, you know, I got something better. Rub this on there. And you come back a little while later, and he says, so you're all fixed? No, Doc, actually, it's getting bigger, and it's really hurting. Well, I guess I'm going to have to give you the best I got. This will fix it. And you come back later, and you say, Doc, I've used all that medicine up, and it ain't working. And the doctor has no more ideas. And he watches you become eat up with cancer and die that death. Now what happens one day shortly after that when somebody comes into the office and says, Doc, I've got this little bump right here. And the doc goes, oh my God. And well, what are you freaking out for? Doc, it's just a little bump. Surely you got something for it. Did you know that there was a time back in the days when doctors were crying when they pronounced you an alcoholic because they'd seen what it does? We don't know that much these days. You know, Fred in chapter 3, Fred landed in the hospital. He thought to rest his nerves, you know. And it says the doctor intimated he might be worse off than he thought. You know, doctors had to try to break it to you kindly. There's a story called The Unbeliever in the first edition, and I love this story because he's the guy that's sitting there as the doctor is telling him. It made me cry to read it. Because he's saying, Doc, so what now? You say I'm a what? An alcoholic. Well, okay, so big deal. What do I do for that? And he said, why are you crying, Doctor? Well, what's the matter? Why are you crying? That's the way it used to be. We know you're on a slow train to hell. And I wish I could stop it for you, but I don't know what we'll do it. In the doctor's opinion, it says this. It says, if any feel, this is Dr. Silkworth, if any feel as psychiatrist of a nationally prominent hospital treating alcoholism and drug addiction, we appear somewhat sentimental. What does that mean? They're choking up. Tears. We appear somewhat sentimental. Stand with us on the firing line for a while and see the tragedies. The desperate wives and the little children that get caught up in it. And none will wonder why we have embraced this movement. We're hoping Alcoholics Anonymous is going to work too. Here's what it says in the Keys of the Kingdom. It says, you know, when I read the stories in the back of the big book, there's a lot of them. There's not one back there that's exactly my story, but all of them have a common thread. that runs through every one of them stories that I relate to, and it's the spiraling descent into hell. Progression. Here's one of the stories, The Keys of the Kingdom. And this guy talks about his last 3 years. The next 3 years saw me in sanitariums, once in a 10-day coma from which I very nearly did not recover, in and out of hospitals, or confined at home with day and night nursing. By now I wanted to die, but had lost the courage to take my life. And all the while I had a growing fear that I was going to have to be locked up in some institution. People didn't behave this way outside of an asylum. Heart sickness, shame, and fear bordering on panic. And no complete escape any longer, except in oblivion. By now everyone agreed that only a miracle could save me. But where do you find a prescription for a miracle? For about 1 year prior to this time, there was one doctor who still struggled with me. Why he bothered with me as long as he did, I will never know. For he knew there was no answer for me in medicine. And he, like all the doctors of those days, had been taught. You want to know what all the doctors back in those days were taught? All of them. If you went to any medical university across this country to become a doctor, and in the class as you discuss various illnesses, and someone say, "Hey, professor, what about alcoholism?" Here's what all universities and all doctors were taught: that the alcoholic is incurable and should be ignored. Doctors were advised to attend patients who could be benefited by medicine. With the alcoholic, he could only give temporary relief, and in the final stages, not even that. It was a waste of the doctor's time. He said, in the spring of 1939, a very remarkable book rolled off of a New York press entitled Alcoholics Anonymous. My good doctor got me a copy of this book. He thought it would be a good idea for me to travel to Akron. This man was in Chicago. He said he thought it'd be a good idea for me to travel to Akron, and he had someone come and pick him up and take him there to find out what was going on with this movement. And the man said, "I was ready to go into the interiors of the African jungle if that's what it took." The desperation of a drowning man. Not many of us ever come that far down through the progression these days. We got AA meetings anywhere you want to go whenever you're ready. We don't really know what it's like to be living in the days of a progressive, unstoppable, slow, miserable death. And I was thinking about that. He was ready to travel to the interior of the African jungle to find some kind of help. And I was thinking, God, I wonder if I'd do that today. I don't even relate to that. But you know, then I remember my childhood, because I was born with an incurable progressive eye disease. And I was born with it. So my childhood was more stress on my parents probably than me. I didn't really know what was going on as a baby and a kid. But I know my parents were fighting it to try to save my sight. And I was constantly in and out of hospitals, having eye surgeries, just trying to hang on to, trying to slow it down or stop it. You know, it was the fight against the inevitable. When I was 2 years old, my mother told me that she was sitting in the recovery room, and I died on the hospital table just from the anesthetic, you know. And she was sitting there waiting for him to bring me out. And she sees all these special medical people rushing in because they got the call that my heart had stopped. And they're shooting adrenaline into my heart. And she's saying, "What's happening? What's happening?" And they just pushed her aside. They wouldn't talk to her. And, you know, they were attending to me. And she knew something was wrong. That must have been hell on my mother. She was about, I don't know, 25 years old at the time. And when I was 5 years old, I can remember back till I was 5 years old. I don't remember the two-year-old incident, but back when I was 5 years old, I remember going to the eye doctor for my usual checkup and him, you know, freaking out and saying, "Oh my God, it's getting out of control." And, you know, this is hard for me to talk about because I think of my parents. what they must have went through fighting this. And I remember I had the number two world-renowned eye doctor down there in Houston to treat this particular illness. But he said, he was in a panic that day, and he said, the number one doctor is in San Francisco. If you can get there quick enough, maybe we can stop it. Now, this is back in the early 50s. We didn't have interstates. And I remember my mother coming home from that doctor's office visit and screeching into the driveway and slamming on the brakes and running in the house and grabbing a suitcase, and we were off as fast as you could go. And my aunt went with us. My dad didn't even finish school. He's trying to make money to pay for all this, you know. He had to stay home and work. But I remember as my aunt climbed in the car, because she had the map, she's going to be, you know, reading the map, trying to find the shortest way to get to San Francisco and the fastest way. And I remember watching my dad hand my mother a pistol, because he was afraid for her to be on the road alone. My mother was a good-looking girl when she was young. And I remember driving as fast as we can, trying to get to San Francisco, trying to find the shortest roads through. And all I can remember, because I used to enjoy riding in the car at night because I could see headlights. And I enjoyed seeing the headlights. And I just remember the night driving. We didn't stop. It was day and night. And then I remember a cop pulling us over. And my mother tried to explain why she was speeding. And he was just a brute. And he wasn't going to let her go on. He was going to make her, you know how they do if you're out of town, or they make you drive all the way back to town. We were 40 miles out of town. He made us turn around and go back 40 miles to pay that ticket right now. And my mother called my dad, and my dad was going to get on a plane and come kill that cop for stopping us. You know, I got to San Francisco in time. And they did stop the urgency of that episode, and I came back to Houston. But, you know, when I was 8 years old, I woke up one night with my left eye hurting so bad. And we had to call the doctor. We had to get him up. We had to go to the hospital, and they had to take out my left eye. That was as far as that one could go. And then when I was 9 years old, the same thing happened with the right eye, as far as, you know, the oh my God, we got to do something. If you could get back to San Francisco. And the same thing in the car, on the rush, trying to get there. And we made it. Stopped that episode. But by this time, my parents are starting to realize that they're fighting against the inevitable. And so my folks decided to send me to the blind school. 1958. And I remember my mother. Did you watch the movie Ray? When his mother was putting him on the bus? I remember that day that my mother put me on the bus. I'm 9 years old, and I'm leaving home. And I was scared. And I remember getting on the bus, and she set me right next to her window, and then she went and got off. And I'm leaving home. And I remember my mother coming around the side of the bus and tapping on the glass just to let me know she was going to stand beside me until the bus left. I put my face up against the glass so I could see her. And I never will forget this. It's one of my most vivid visual memories that I have. I was just sitting there watching my mother. And then the bus started to go. And as it's pulling away, I just watched my mother fold over and start crying. And some guy running over to pick her up and help her. Fighting the inevitable. Taking down the whole family. I've always wished I could do something to repay my parents, and never did really achieve it because I was an alcoholic. But when I was 15, the second eye went, and same thing. I woke up and the eye was hurting, and they had to rush me to the hospital and take it out. And I remember how scared I was that they were, because I was raised believing as long as we could hang on to some kind of sight, maybe someday they'll come up with a cure. And that day when that doctor looked at my right eye and said, "It's got to come out, take him to the hospital." And I remember grabbing that doctor and saying, "No. No, that would be the end." And it was a traumatic experience for me to have to lose my left eye, because that meant there was no more hope. I mean, my right eye, your left. But you know what? When I woke up from that surgery and I had all them bandages on my eyes, because, see, my whole life up to then had been in and out of the doctor's office constantly, in and out of the hospital and having surgeries, trying to stop various episodes. And I took eye drops every 2 hours. I took pills after every meal, and it was just constant medicine. And I hated it. And they told me, don't get bumped on the head. So as a kid, I wasn't really allowed to get out and roughhouse and play with the other kids. I had to be kind of careful. And my whole life was dominated by this situation. And I remember waking up from that surgery after having that last eye removed, and I thought, at least it's over. All of that struggle is over. And there was a peace in that. You know, I'm going to read something from the employers. To the employers, this guy says, I was at one time an assistant manager of a department employing 6,600 men. One day my secretary came in to say that Mr. B was on the phone and wanted to talk with me. I told her to say to him that I was not interested. I had warned him several times that he had but one more chance. Not long afterward, he called me from Hartford on two successive days, so drunk he could hardly talk. I told him that he was through, finally and forever. My secretary returned to say it was not Mr. B on the phone, it was Mr. B's brother, and he wished to speak to me. I still expected a plea for clemency, but these words came through the phone. I just wanted to tell you that Paul jumped from a hotel window in Hartford last Saturday. He left us a note saying that you were the best boss he ever had and was not to blame in any way. Another time, as I opened a letter which lay on my desk, a newspaper clipping fell out. It was the obituary of one of the best salesmen I ever had. After 2 weeks of drinking, he placed his toe on the trigger of a loaded shotgun. The barrel was in his mouth. I had discharged him for drinking 6 weeks before. Still another time, a woman's voice came faintly over long distance from Virginia. She wanted to know if her husband's insurance was still in force. 4 days before, he had hanged himself in his woodshed. I had been obliged to discharge him for drinking. I know how every one of them felt. As he put the gun in his mouth, he thought, at least it will be over. As he jumped from the window, he said, at least it will be over. As he put the rope around his neck, he thought, at least it will be over. Not many of us these days ride alcoholism that far down the road. But we have that disease, if you want to play with it. And so, it says, thanks for the information. I know now more than ever that I must not pick up the first drink. So here's the hopeless feature of the malady of alcoholism. This is D, the mental blank spot, which means that you will, no matter how much I try to scare you out of it, if you're like me. The big book says we are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago, and we are without defense against the first drink. At certain times, not any day, many days and most days, when I've had enough and I'm determined, I can say no to a drink without your help, without God's help. Most days I can say no, but there's a day when I can't, and it only takes one bad day to throw me back into the loop. And each time I come out a little more scarred and a little more burnt, with the guarantee that no matter how hard I try, one day I'll fall back into the loop. You know, Jim was one of these guys. He got a couple of months sober and then began to rest on his laurels. It says he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. And one day he drove out, he was a car salesman, he drove out to the edge of town where he thought somebody might be interested in buying a car, and he went into this restaurant that he was very familiar with to have a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still no thought of drinking. He said, I sat down at a table and I ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still no thought of drinking. He wasn't planning to. Wasn't even toying with the idea. He ate his first sandwich and a glass of milk and decided to have another sandwich and a glass of milk. And he said, suddenly the thought crossed my mind that, hey, I've got food on my stomach. It wouldn't bother me if I drank just an ounce of whiskey in this milk. He said, I ordered a whiskey and poured it into the milk. And he said, I had a vague sense. I was not being any too smart. But not sufficient force. Thus started one more journey to the asylum for Jim. Fred was another guy, landed in the hospital to rest his nerves. And the doctor intimated he might be worse than he thought. And the doctor sent for some AA people and they came and talked to him. They told him the A, B, C, and D of alcoholism. He said he was interested and agreed he had some of the symptoms. A, B, and C. But D, the mental blank spot. The hopeless feature of the malady? Oh, no. The insanity that precedes the first... No, I don't have that. He said he agreed he had some of the symptoms, but he is a long ways from admitting he could do nothing about it himself. He was sure that this humiliating experience, plus all the information they had told him about alcoholism, was sufficient to keep him sober the rest of his life. And he was just going to exercise his willpower and keep on guard. And in that frame of mind, he left the hospital, and for a time, all went well. In fact, all went well for a year. With no help. Just determination and enough information and scared into picking up the first drink. He's going to exercise his willpower and keep on guard. Then he went off to Washington and had a very successful business trip. And he went back to the hotel for dinner. And he said, as I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought crossed my mind, it'd be nice to have a cocktail with dinner. So I sat down and ordered a cocktail with my meal. Look at that. He didn't even have a vague sense he wasn't supposed to do that. He was completely blank on this day, and all them other days in the past year, when he had that thought, he'd say, no, sir. I heard what them cats said. I know what'll happen if I pick up a drink. No way. I'm not going to do that. No, it's not me. No way. And on this day, it tapped him on the shoulder and said, how about a drink today? And he said, all right. Had a drink. It never crossed his mind. He shouldn't do that. That's the mental blank spot. If I don't just get pissed off at my boss or my old lady and go out and get drunk at them, you know. But I'm still determined to stay sober. This day will hit me. Eventually. He said, I sat down at a table and ordered a cocktail with my meal. And thus started one more trip back to the hospital for Fred. He said, in the hospital, as soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that day in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I gave no thought whatever to the first drink. And now I remembered what the alcoholic said, that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again. Well, just that did happen. For what I learned about alcoholism didn't occur to me at all. I knew then that self-knowledge and willpower would not help in those strange mental blank spots. I knew then that I had an alcoholic mind. It was a crushing blow. Because back in those days, it was a crushing blow to receive that diagnosis. So he called for the AA people and they come back. And then they outlined the spiritual answer and the program of action. He said it was pretty drastic. But the moment I made up my mind to go through the process, I had the curious feeling my alcoholism was relieved, as indeed it proved to be. Quite as important was the discovery that these same spiritual principles would solve all the problems in my life. Whoa, what a program. You mean it's not just about fixing my alcoholism? No, the principles that produces my recovery from alcoholism, that relieves me from that insanity, I can apply the same principles to all my life and watch God just spill over into all my life. What a program. I'm going to close with this. Women suffer too. I like this. She said, I went trembling. Now this is a woman also under psychiatric care, hospital care, and the doctors knew no more what to do. And they heard about AA. and they sent her. She said, I went trembling into a house in Brooklyn filled with strangers and found that I had come home at last to my own kind. That was the beginning of a new life, a fuller life, a happier life than I'd ever known or believed possible. I had found friends, understanding friends, who often knew what I was thinking and feeling better than I knew myself. They didn't allow me to retreat back into my prison of fear and loneliness. Talking things over with them showed me myself as I really was. And it didn't stop there. They knew what to do about those black abysses that yawned, ready to swallow me up in depression or anxiety. But they had a concrete program. They knew what to do about that black, yawning, bottomless pit that wants to suck me into it. They had a concrete program. What does concrete mean?
Solid.
Pretty damn solid. They had a concrete program designed to secure the greatest possible inner security for us. Have you found that? Or are you missing it? In the spring of 1939, a very remarkable book rolled off of a New York press. And it says in the foreword of that book, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered. Precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. I hope you're not depending on just the chit-chat that goes on in AA meetings. Some of it's good. Some of it ain't. Do you know the difference? Not if you don't read the book. You don't know the difference. Lack of power. That was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Exactly. My friends, in the pages of this book is a prescription for a miracle that will spill over into your entire life. And it says, the central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. I read that one day and thought, wow, what a beautiful passage. I'm going to write that down. I'm going to memorize it. And I'm going to quote it in a meeting one day so everybody will go, wow. Did you hear what he said? Because, you know, we like these verses, these passages in the big book where it says, miraculous. The age of miracles is still with us. Oh, listen, you know, those are pretty. We like them. But as I'm writing it, I thought, I don't think they really meant miraculous, did they? That was just, you know, poetic license. I mean, they meant that metaphorically, right? I mean, not literal, it was figuratively, right? I mean, surely they didn't mean literally. So I read it again, and it said, the central fact, I must have missed that word. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute, certainty, that our Creator has entered in our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed, wow, miraculous. Dang, they put four adjectives in that sentence to make sure I understood that they did indeed mean that this is an absolute certain fact. The miraculous. And it's the central fact of our lives today. It's the common denominator of certain people in AA. Their common denominator is the absolute certainty that they're experiencing the miraculous, and don't doubt it. And it's the people who have read and understand and know how to apply the prescription for a miracle. It's the central fact of our lives today. Is that the central fact of your life today? The absolute certainty that God is going to meet your needs. That God is going to provide what you need. That He's going to do remarkable things. That He's going to remove your difficulties. That victory over them will bear witness to those you will help. That if you will follow the dictates of this book, you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what the present circumstance or the world economy or the state of the nation. And yet I hear people that kind of, you know, like, you know, don't bring too much of that book in this room. Why? Oh, I don't know. It just makes some people uncomfortable. I tell you what, life will make you uncomfortable, my friend. So, I have discovered the difference between a program without much book and a program with a lot of book. And I hope I can inspire you to do the same. God bless.